Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, Thursday, June 25th. And we're going to start talking about axial skeleton. So we got a little introduction in lab regarding axial skeleton. So we'll finish up in lecture today. But before we do that, let's take a look at the schedule. And we are right on schedule. So today, indeed, is the 25th, lecture on axial skeleton, that's chapter 7. And then after lab, I'm going to go upstairs and open up the study room, in case you guys want to look at some of the models in the study room right next to the anatomy lab. Otherwise, I'd open up a lab anatomy lab for you, but the practicum is set up already, so you can't go in there until about 10 o'clock. Right? And so I'll be out in the hall in case you got any questions. Look at the display cabinet. Can look at all your stuff online to help prepare for that practicum that's coming up. And the practicum is going to be on labs 1, 2, and 3. 1, 2, and 3. Okay. And your lab manual is the answer key to the lab practicum. All right. Anybody have a question on the schedule at all? Anybody going anywhere this weekend? Fun? Probably not, huh? Probably not even next weekend. Okay, me neither. All right, so here are some landmarks on bones. We talked about these things already. I just want to review a couple of them. There are four major kinds of landmarks that we're going to look at a bone. A raised landmark that is rough is a process of some kind. There's some specific names of processes that have a real fancy shape to them or a location, like a tubercle or a malleolus, right? Tuberosity, tubercle, these are all special kinds of processes. And then there's some general ones like a crest or a spine or a line. There can be many different kinds of lines on bones. It's just a process that is long and narrow, and it's not raised very much. Okay. A process. The function of a process is that something attaches there, usually a muscle. Most of the time it's a muscle, but it could be another ligament, for instance. But mostly it's a tendon that attaches to that part of the bone, and the muscle is pulling on the bone all the time, and it's causing the bone to get stronger and bigger. We call that hypertrophy. The second kind of landmark is a depression, and a fossa is a general name for a depression. So it's a bowl, and just like around the house, what do you do with a bowl? You hold something with it, right? So there's going to be something in that depression. It could be an organ, it could be a blood vessel, it could be a nerve. And here are a couple special names of depressions. A sulcus and a groove is sort of like the reverse of a line. It's a long and narrow depression. For instance, if there's a blood vessel moving across a bone or something, a blood vessel is long and not very wide. Okay, so a sulcus and a groove are exactly the same thing. An alveolus is what we find in the maxilla and mandible that the root of a tooth fits into. So it's like a socket in this particular case that the root of the tooth fits in. So think of a peg and socket kind of joint. The next thing is a hole. And a hole, general name for hole is foramen. And the purpose of a hole in the bone is that it's a passageway for something. Could be an artery, could be a vein, could be a nerve, and a lot of times it's all three. And sometimes there might even be some other things going through a hole in a bone. And a hole in a bone that's really long, okay, is what we call a canal. It's still a foramen, but if it goes in a bone and kind of snakes around a little bit before it exits the other side, that would be a canal. A fissure is a long and narrow hole in a bone. And another kind of hole, I put it in the list right here, a sinus, okay, or a cavity. It's a hole, but it might not really have access to the outside of the bone. It just might be a hole on the inside of the bone. So we would call that a cavity, like medullary cavity. A hole is a passageway. In this particular case, a sinus actually would be for holding something, not necessarily a passageway, but it's for holding something. So sinus, you could almost think of as a fossa, but it's completely surrounded by bone. And a smooth articulating surface for forming joints between bones, and these surfaces should be smooth. It's a raised area, kind of like a process, but a process is rough. This area is going to be smooth. Generally, we're going to call that a condyle. And the function of a condyle is for articulation. And there are some special kinds of articulations. There could be a head, there could be a facet, and then there are some special ones we're going to talk about next time, like the trochlea and capitulum. These are special articulating surfaces that help make up your elbow. And we're going to pay particular attention to them. And then you're familiar with a ramus, right? Because that was on the quiz last time. What bone did you guys look at last time that has a ramus? The mandible. Yeah, ramus is when you have some part of anatomy making a 90 degree turn with respect to some major part of that structure. Right? Like the body of the mandible is the horizontal part, the ramus is the vertical part that goes up toward the temporal bone. Okay, so those are just some general terms that you got to be familiar with. We'll use them all the time, so it just becomes second nature to you. You won't even have to think about them. All right, on the slide, we see a skeleton. And when you look at the skeleton right here, you see two main colors. And the two main colors represent the two main divisions. All the bones in the skeleton, we can break up into two divisions. One division are all the bones that make up your appendages, your upper appendage, right, which would be your arm, your forearm, your wrist, and your hand. That's your upper appendage. And that's part of your appendicular skeleton, as well as your lower appendage, which includes your thigh and leg, ankle, and foot. That's your lower appendage. So that's part of your appendicular skeleton. And then the last thing that we want to include in appendicular skeleton are the bones that are necessary to attach your appendicular skeleton to your axial skeleton. And for the lower appendage, it is these hip bones. And for the upper appendage, it's the clavicle and scapula. So we're going to pay particular attention to that next week. But right now, we're going to finish up looking at the axial skeleton, which is skull, vertebral column, rib cage, okay, and sternum. So that's the axial skeleton. All these things are right smack in the middle of the body. All right, and here's just a posterior view. So anybody have a question on this axial skeleton? What the heck it is? All right, it's like running right down the midline of your body. Okay, so skull. You see it has 28 bones right here, and I'm not going to ask you the number of these particular bones, but just to give you a little rough idea of the things that you have to know. Some of these bones of the 28 right here are in pairs, and so there's not like really 28 separate bones because some of them exist in pairs. Do you have an idea of, can you give me the name of a bone that you have two of in your skull? Do you remember any bones that you have in your skull that you actually have two of? Like one on the right, one on the left is probably a good way to think of that. Sphenoid, I can see the sphenoid on the right. I can see it on the left, but you know what? That's because it goes all the way across. So there's only one sphenoid. And think of it like right smack in the center, but it has wings that go out to the side. All right, what's zygomatic bone. Yeah, what's a really nice way to describe to somebody where the zygomatic bone is? Where's zygomatic bone? It's like your cheekbone, okay? The cheekbone, zygomatic bone. Yeah, you got two of those. And you probably are thinking, well, gee whiz, all these bones, if I have one on the right, I got one on the left. And this is true because we exhibit bilateral symmetry. And there's never a case where you have a bone that's anterior and a similar bone that is posterior because we don't have symmetry in our body in that direction. It's only from right to left. Okay, and we have one hyoid bone. I didn't mention this one in lab. This is kind of a funny one, but I'll show you where it is. It's underneath your mandible, but I wouldn't actually poke around to try to find it. Right? It's really hard to palpate, and it's kind of fragile. If you poke hard enough to find it, you might actually break it. Right? So you just got to know it's in there, and I'll show you where that is in a second. Vertebral column's got 26. Thoracic cage got 25 bones. So these are all the things that we want to look at. Okay, appendicular skeleton, we're going to talk about next time, arms, legs, and the girdles. All the girdles are the things that attach your appendages to your axial skeleton, right? Like your scapula and clavicle. That's the pectoral girdle. So we'll see that next time. All right, so in the skull, this could be on the practicum coming up. All right, so here is a nice illustration of a skull on the right-hand side. And just like the skeleton, we can break down into two components. The skull, we can break down into two components as well. There are bones that make up facial bones. These are important for eating and breathing and articulation, right? But they don't help protect the brain. They're there for other kinds of purposes and functions. The bones that form the armor plating of the brain, we call cranial bones, right? So all the bones of the skull can be broken down into cranial bones and facial bones for those two different purposes. And, okay, so you had a quiz on this, so you're probably really familiar with all of these different sutures, right? Like the coronal suture, because it lines up in the coronal plane. What's another name for coronal plane? Yeah, frontal or coronal are exactly the same. Here's the temporal bone. Here's a flat region of the temporal bone. So this is called the squamous suture, lambdoid suture between the parietal and occipital bone. And what bone is this where I have the cursor right now? What bone is that? Okay, that's the frontal bone. And then I can see the frontal bone actually making up part of the eye socket. The eye socket we call an orbit. And part of the frontal bone helps make the roof of the orbit. And so this thing right here, does anybody know what this part of the frontal bone would be called? Okay, it's part of the frontal bone, help making the orbit. And it's a plate, it's kind of flat. So this is the orbital plate of the frontal bone. And so a couple bones have orbital plates, like the zygomatic does, because it helps make up the orbit. And the ethmoid does, helps make up the orbit. Okay. And then here is a bone that somebody mentioned, right, the sphenoid. Indeed, you can see the sphenoid in this particular case on the right, but you can also see it on the left because it goes all the way across. So the sphenoid bone would be right here. If you look inside the cranium, you can see that there are three main depressions. Here's the anterior cranial fossa, here's the posterior cranial fossa, and here is the middle. And so these just hold different lobes of the brain, like the frontal lobe goes up over here, temporal lobe goes down in the middle, and occipital lobe fits really nicely in the posterior cranial fossa. So again, a fossa is just there for holding something. Okay. Nice, we can see all that. All right, here was your quiz. Does anybody have a question about this nice lateral view of the skull? This is an important exam figure for your next lecture exam, and this you should probably know all this stuff for the practicum today. Right, so it's nicely color-coded, so you can see the bones separated from each other very nicely. Right, so I can see the angle of the ramus of the mandible. Here's the angle where it makes that 90-degree bent. I see a couple processes over here. This big, thick one is the mastoid process. This little thin one is styloid process. What's the function of this styloid process? Function of this process right here. It's for muscle attachment, right? So when somebody asks you a process, you should just automatically think of muscle attachment. That's going to be right most of the time. Here is mandibular condyle. It helps make up the TMJ. So what's the function of a condyle? Remember, it's a smooth surface. It's a raised area on a bone, but it's a smooth surface. And the function of a condyle is for articulation. It helps make a joint. Okay, here's a coronoid process on the mandible, once again. And what's the function of this coronoid process? Yeah, you're going to be really bored with me today. That's muscle attachment, right? So when I say process, muscle attachment is what you're going to want to say. All right, and then here is a hole, which is a foramen. This is in the mental region of the mandible. So it's called the mental foramen. And, you know, there's a muscle right here. And take a guess at what the name of that muscle is. Okay, so here's the mental foramen. In the mental region of the mandible, the muscle right here is called the mentalis, right? So again, when you learn bones, you learn so much other kinds of anatomy that it's really helpful to become familiar with your bones. What else do I want to say about this one? Here is a hole in a bone, a meatus, but it doesn't go all the way through the temporal bone. It just enters the temporal bone and stops. And right on the other side of this external acoustic meatus is a special region in the temporal bone that holds a number of really interesting organs that help us maintain equilibrium and help us hear things. And You should probably know what the name of that part of the temporal bone is between the external acoustic meatus and the internal acoustic meatus. It starts with a P. The petrous region. Yeah, petrous region. Sometimes words that start with a P, you don't pronounce the P, but in that word you do. Okay? Okay. I'll remind you of that when I see that sphenoid bone. Okay, sagittal suture, lambdoid suture. Here are what we call Wormian bones. I can see in this lambdoid suture, Wormian bone or sutural bone are exactly the same thing. Highly variable. There might be many of us that don't have any of these little things that are located right within a suture, and some of us might have quite a few. So it just all depends on development and probably nutrition and all kinds of stuff. All right, nice frontal view of the skull. So I see a foramen below the orbit. I see a foramen above the orbit. And so here is the orbit. The name for the foramen above is the supra, right? Superior means above, and inferior means below. So here's the infraorbital foramen. So we're just looking at some terminology. Sometimes this foramen, really close to the superior margin of the orbit, is not a complete foramen. It's not a complete circle. And if it breaks out into the margin of the orbit, then we would just call that a notch instead. But I see a foramen here and a foramen here. There are plenty of skulls in lab that actually just have a little notch at this location. All right, so here I see the sphenoid bone on the right, and I see it helps make up the posterior part of the orbit, and then I see it then over here once again, and then I see it on the exterior on the left side of the skull. So indeed, that sphenoid bone goes all the way across. So here's a hole in the sphenoid bone, but it's not round. It's long. It's elongated. It's long and narrow. So this is what we call a fissure, right? Superior orbital fissure. Here's the inferior orbital fissure. So there are nerves, blood vessels that move through this area. The maxilla are right here and right here. Here is a separation that separates the nasal cavity from the right side and the left side. And if we have a wall in our body that's separating two areas, two cavities or two spaces, sometimes we call that a septum, right? So a wall or a septum are kind of the same thing. It separates a big chamber into two smaller chambers. And since this is in the nasal cavity, this is called the nasal septum. Nasal septum is made up of two bones. Down inferior is the vomer, and above it is part of the ethmoid bone. So these are the two bones that make this nasal septum. And then I can see some wings also inside the nasal cavity. These are what we call conchae, nasal conchae. And we actually have three sets, but on this figure I can only see two. I can see the inferior nasal concha and the middle nasal concha. And this one's called the middle because there's another superior one up over here, but you can't see it. All right, so it's hidden in this illustration. The superior and the middle are part of the ethmoid bone. Maybe you could tell that it has the right kind of color to it. But this inferior nasal concha is a bone all by itself. It's not. It attaches to bones that make up the nasal cavity, but it's a standalone bone by itself. There's a joint right there. These nasal conchae have a couple functions, right? They're covered with a mucous membrane, and when we breathe in, that mucous membrane humidifies the air. If we're breathing in some really dry air, that could dehydrate our lungs, right? That helps humidify the air. And if the air is really hot that we're breathing in, then these nasal conchae can cool the air down before it gets to the lungs, so it helps protect our lungs from burning. Or if the air is really cold, it can warm the air up so we don't freeze our lungs. So these nasal concha are pretty important. But like I said, right, you could think of these as wings. They also help organize the air flow as it's moving through the nasal cavity so that it's nice and smooth flowing. We call that laminar flow. So it reduces turbulence, so it's actually a lot easier for us to inhale and exhale if the air flows in and nice sheets over these wings, as opposed to like forming turbulence, then it would be really hard to get air in and out of our lungs. And that's really what this nasal septum does as well. It helps organize the air as we're breathing in so that it flows nice and smoothly and fast in and out of our body. Okay, so that's the skull pretty much. Right. Here is not an exam figure. Okay, but I can see the occipital bone, I can see the temporal bones. Here are the two maxilla. These are what we call the palatine processes of the maxilla. Even though they're on the maxilla, they touch the palatine bone, which is right here. So a lot of times we will name a process on a bone, not by the name of the bone that it's on, but by the name of the bone that it touches. All right, so this part of the maxilla is touching the palatine bone, which I see right here, so we name that the palatine process. All right, palatine process on the maxilla touches the palatine bone, and the palatine bone helps make up the roof of the mouth along with the maxilla. These bones right here sometimes are called the hard palate, as opposed to the soft palate, which would be some soft tissues that cover these bones. Okay, hard palate. There's a little foramen, or sometimes there's an alveolus right here. We call that the incisive foramen because it's right between the two front teeth, which are the incisors. So here I see the largest hole in the skull. So somebody tell me the name of this largest hole right here. Yeah, foramen magnum. That's really nice and easy to see. And then here is a rough raised area on the occipital bone. This rough raised area is going to sit on top of the first cervical vertebrae. It's going to touch the first cervical vertebrae. What do we call something, an area where two bones come together? It's an area where two bones come together, and maybe it allows for motion between those two bones. Okay, that is, I'm not quite sure I can hear. Okay, it's a joint, right, or an articulation. All right, so what kind of thing is important for an articulation? Did you remember a landmark that's used for an articulation? Something that makes an articulation on a bone. Yeah, it's a raised area, but since it makes an articulation, it's got to be smooth. And a raised, smooth area on a bone is a condyle, and I see one right here, and I see one right here. So these are condyles that form the joint between your vertebral column and your skull. And as a matter of fact, these are condyles that I mentioned, and what are the name of these condyles? We would name them after the bone that they're on. And what bone is this once again? The occipital bone. So these are the occipital condyles. And what's right underneath it is the first vertebrae. And that's going to articulate with that. All right. I'll go forward just a little bit. Now I want to go back to that nice lateral view that we had here. All right, so here I see temporal bone. Here's that cheekbone or zygomatic. And then here is something we call the zygomatic arch. You can't get a really good impression when you just look laterally, but there's a big space between the zygomatic arch and the sphenoid and the temporal bone. So this is like a bridge going across over here, made up partly of the zygomatic, partly of the temporal bone. And we're going to name these processes on the temporal bone and zygomatic bone. And listen to how I describe this. Once you see how it works, it's really easy to use this nomenclature for naming a lot of things. But until you see it, sometimes it's a difficult concept. So here is a process on the temporal bone. And here's the zygomatic bone. Here's a process on the zygomatic bone. They come together to form the zygomatic arch. So how would we name this part of the temporal bone that touches the zygomatic? We don't want to name this process after the temporal bone. We want to name it after the bone that it touches. So what bone does this piece of the temporal bone touch? The zygomatic. So we want to call this thing the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. Okay. Let's work it the other way. So here's the zygomatic bone, and here's a process on the zygomatic bone. And what bone does this process of the zygomatic touch? It touches the temporal bone, so we want to name this process the temporal process of the zygomatic bone because it's touching the temporal bone. Okay. So there are a lot of processes that you don't have to know in this class because it's not in your lab list, but you could name them anyway. So here again is the zygomatic bone. Here's a process that's reaching way up over here and touching this bone. What is this bone here? Yeah, it's the frontal bone, right? And then here's the inside the orbit. That's the orbital plate of the frontal bone. Remember that? Okay. So here is the zygomatic bone. Here's a process on the zygomatic bone. What would we name this process on the zygomatic bone? And remember, here is the frontal bone. It's touching the frontal bone. So this right here is the, okay, it's on the zygomatic bone. So this is the, and touching the frontal, so it's the frontal process of the zygomatic bone because it's touching the frontal bone. Not because it's in the front, but because it's actually touching this frontal bone. All right, here's another process that I see on the zygomatic bone. And it's touching this one here. And what is this one here? That's the maxilla. So go ahead and name this process on the zygomatic bone. It is the maxillary process of the zygomatic bone. Okay? So maybe ask me in lab a bunch of times. If you don't see it, it's really confusing until you see it, and then it's really easy. All right, so we'll try to just help everybody see the way you would name those different things. Okay. There's only one joint in the skull that's movable, and that is the temporomandibular joint, which is right here. Otherwise, we just call that the TMJ. All these other joints are immovable joints, and we call these in the skull sutures, right? Okay. All right, so we looked at all these bones, right? There are three bones that are really hard to see, and I don't have a picture in this particular chapter. The auditory ossicles. And whenever you hear that term osseo or osteo, what should you be thinking? Bone, right? So an ossicle is a little bone. And here are three of them, the malleus, incus, and stapes. And they're deep inside the temporal bone. And I could have all three between my fingertips. And you know what? You wouldn't be able to say that I don't have them between my fingertips. They're so small, they could just fit right there without any problem. Right, they're really important for hearing, and that's part of the job of the temporal bone. It holds the organ for hearing, and it needs these bones. When we get to special senses, we'll talk about these bones, but they're buried deep inside the temporal bone, so you can't see them. Right, talked about the nasal conchae, and here is one that I haven't showed you even in lab, and that is the hyoid bone. Let me find a hyoid bone. All right, so here we have a nice, like a mannequin. Here's the mandible, so here's the body of the mandible. Here is the hyoid bone, and it almost looks like a mandible. It's horseshoe-shaped, and it fits right up into the mandible, right? And it's there for muscle attachment. I see it has a bunch of processes on it, and these muscles are really important for articulation and for eating, right, and breathing, swallowing, and we don't really talk about many of these muscles, but this bone you should know because it's kind of hidden. And in lab later today, I'll pull a bunch of these hyoids out and you can see what they look like. All right, so they're tucked up right within the mandible. Some cavities. Well, the cranial cavity, nasal cavity, oral cavity are easy to find. All right, the paranasal sinuses. There are four paranasal sinuses. There's sphenoid, maxillary, frontal, and ethmoid. Where would you find the frontal paranasal sinus? Tell me the name of the bone. That frontal bone. Where would you find the maxillary paranasal sinus? The maxilla, right? So they're just named after the bone that they're on, so that's not really difficult. So where do we find these things? Here's a pretty good illustration. All right, so here's your mandible, indeed, and then your upper jawbone is your maxilla, and if you look at a maxilla, you'd have to cut it open. Here is the maxillary paranasal sinus. Then here is the frontal bone. Can anybody tell me what this raised area is right between our eyes on the frontal bone? The glabella, that's right. So here's the glabella. Underneath the glabella is a big cavity. We call that the frontal sinus because that's the frontal bone. And then remember, the sphenoid bone goes all the way across. right behind, and it helps make up the posterior part of the orbit, goes all the way across. It has some big cavities in it as well that I can see here and here. This is a little bit posterior, so since they're in the sphenoid bone, we call these the sphenoid paranasal sinuses. Then right in front of the sphenoid is the ethmoid bone, and it has a bunch of holes in it, and so we're going to call these the ethmoid sinuses. Okay. Let's see if I can have here's a good lateral view. Nice. All right, so frontal sinus in the frontal bone, maxillary in the maxilla, sphenoid way in the back posterior, right, and then anterior to the sphenoid, I have a bunch of sinuses in the ethmoid bone. So those are the four. So if we look at a nice cross section instead of this illustration, right, so what do I see? Frontal sinus, sphenoid is way in the back. I can't see the maxillary sinuses, but I can see the ethmoid sinuses, right, because this is just right on midline. What do we call that plane right on midline? This is a mid-sagittal section through this particular skull. Okay? Okay. So that's something about the bones. Let's take a look at some of these disarticulated bones. All right, disarticulated bones. Here's one, really easy to appreciate. All right, so let's look at the cranium, and here is the sphenoid. It goes all the way across. Right, so here is a greater wing. Here's a lesser wing on the sphenoid. It helps make up a little bit of the anterior cranial fossa and the middle cranial fossa. Here's a nice depression. It's a really special depression, so we don't call it a fossa. We call it the sella turcica, and it holds the pituitary gland. So it's a very important structure. And it reminded somebody of a saddle that you would use to ride a horse with, and a typical shape kind of like what you would see from a saddle that was used in the country of Turkey. So it's called the sella turcica. And you can see it's got a couple of horns on it that can be used for stability and roping and things like that. Okay, so I see greater wings, lesser wing. I also see a number of holes in the sphenoid bone. And when we look at the whole cranium, I'm going to get to this pretty soon. When we look at the whole cranium, that is where we're going to be able to label all of these different foramina. And the most anterior one here is the optic foramen, but since it's long and narrow, we call that the optic canal. I want to turn this bone around a little bit. Still, this is the sphenoid, right? You can see the greater wing and lesser wing. And then I have a couple of these processes that are sticking straight down, help make up the oral cavity, and they're called the pterygoid process. Notice you do not pronounce the P, but when you spell it out, that P has got to be there. There are some muscles that are attached to these pterygoid processes that are really important for chewing. And could you tell me the name of these muscles that attach to this pterygoid process? And you could, without hardly using very much imagination. They're called the pterygoid muscles. Okay, pterygoid muscles that attach to the pterygoid process. All right, so I think even though it's spelled with a P, I want everybody to say what this process is. What is this process right here? Yeah, pterygoid process, right? So don't forget about that one, pterygoid process. The major part of the sphenoid bone is just what we call the body. Deep inside the body, guess what we have deep inside the body of the sphenoid bone? Deep inside the sphenoid bone, what did we have? All right, so here is the body of the sphenoid bone. Here's the sella turcica. Here's the body of the sphenoid bone. And what do you see right there? A big cavity, right? So that's why we call that the sphenoid paranasal sinus. Okay, within the sphenoid bone. Do we have a frontal bone? Don't really have a frontal. Yeah, here's that frontal bone. Yeah, so remember glabella. Here's the superior margin of the orbit. And what do we call that part of the frontal bone that helps make the roof of the orbit? Anybody remember that? There are some parts of bones that help make up the orbit. Oh, take a look at this. I saw this over here. Saw this right. Saw this. Pretty good. Okay, so here's the orbit. Here are some bones that make up the orbit. It's part of your pre-lecture reading assignment. So what bone do we see right here? Too bad I don't know the color. Orange, green, something like that. Okay, that's the frontal bone. And then here's that supraorbital foramen, but it's not a complete foramen on this particular skull. It is just a notch, right? Supraorbital notch. But here's the infraorbital foramen. That's a complete foramen. So here's frontal bone. What about this over here? Is this frontal bone inside the orbit? What about, is it the same color? I would hope it is, because this would be, okay, what we call the orbital plate of the frontal bone, right? Orbital plate of the frontal bone. Zygomatic, I see here, has an orbital plate, right? The ethmoid bone, which is over here, has an orbital plate. So there are a number of bones that help make up the orbit. And these smooth surfaces, of course, because the eyeball is going to be in there moving around, they have to be smooth. These are what we call the orbital plates of that particular bone. All right, let me just think a little bit about the skull. Is there anything else I want to say about the skull? I think we're doing pretty good. Who's got a question about the skull? Nomenclature, naming things, anything like that? I think I'm done with the skull. No questions? Okay. Ask me later if you think of a question. All right, so that's part of the axial skeleton. The rest of the axial skeleton is the vertebral column and then the rib cage. Let's take a look at the vertebral column. So the skull is gone, ribs are gone, appendages are gone. This is just a vertebral column made up of vertebrae. And this is the whole vertebral column, and you can see the vertebral column has different divisions, or maybe different levels. I think we can use those words interchangeably. There's one division of vertebrae that are close to your skull. These make up your neck, and we call this the cervical region. They have a particular shape to them, and they're all going to be fit nicely into this classification of cervical vertebrae. And then there's some that help make up the thoracic cage. So all of these vertebrae are what we're going to call thoracic vertebrae. Then there's some down over here that help make up the pelvic and abdominal cavity. So we're going to call these the lumbar vertebrae. And then there's some that are all fused together. And these are called, this is the sacrum. And then there's a couple over here that are fused together. This is the coccyx, or your tailbone. All right, so the sacrum comes together with your hip bones to make a nice pelvic cavity. Okay. So you do have to know how many vertebrae are in each of these divisions. So I'll ask you, how many cervical vertebrae are there? Yeah, there are 7. I can see it right there. How many thoracic vertebrae are there? There are 12. And how many lumbar vertebrae? There are 5. All right, and it's really easy to remember how many there are in each one of these divisions, right? There's 7, 12, and 5. Because that kind of resembles the standard times that people have meals. Like, when do you have breakfast? When do you have breakfast? You don't have breakfast ever. Pretend you had breakfast today. You had it before class, right? Like at 7 o'clock. And when do you have lunch? At noon or 12 o'clock. And when do you have supper? At 5 o'clock, right? So just remember, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, 7, 12, and 5. That will help you remember the number of vertebrae, right, in those different divisions. The sacrum usually has about 5 that are fused together, right? And the coccyx usually has 3, and I say usually because there's some variation. Not so much in the sacrum, but in the coccyx, there's a lot of variation. And even in the thoracic region, there can be some variation. There might be somebody in here that has 11 vertebrae, right? And that's not pathologic, that's just different, right? So that's maybe a little bit abnormal because it's not common, but it's not pathologic in any case. Okay, let me tell you why these vertebrae here are called thoracic vertebrae, right? Because they help make up the thoracic cage. And in order to be a thoracic vertebrae, there has to be another bone attached to it. And the bones that attach to thoracic vertebrae are ribs. So if you have a rib that attached to a vertebrae, that vertebrae by definition has to be a thoracic vertebrae. If there is a vertebrae without a rib attached to it, it cannot be a thoracic vertebrae, right? So cervical right here, 1 through 7, don't have a rib attached to it, can't be thoracic. These down over here, L1, 2, 3, 4, 5, never have a rib attached to it, so can't be thoracic. All right, so it's just a one-to-one correspondence. If you're a person that's missing one of these vertebrae, like I said, it's not pathologic. As a matter of fact, your vertebral column might even be a little bit stronger. It might even be advantageous in some respects. There is a special breed of horses, maybe somebody knows, that's missing a vertebrae or a couple. They're a little bit shorter, but their back is really strong. They're a really hardy horse. Does anybody know that kind of horse that has a little bit shorter, but very, very strong? It's an Arabian horse. Okay. There are some around that you can look at. Okay, so these are the divisions. And you can see that there are some curves. If we look, just a nice anterior view, look right and left, I don't see much in the way of curves in a normal spine. Every once in a while, the vertebral column might actually bend a little bit toward the right to accommodate the heart that would be in this location here. Right, but if we look at a lateral view, I definitely see some normal curvatures. All right, so here is a curvature. We call this the thoracic curvature. It's curving posterior, curving out posteriorly, and that curve is there to accommodate organs that you have inside your body, like your heart and your lungs. All right, and if this vertebral column went straight up, your head would be positioned way back over here, and it would be hard to stand up straight. It would be easy to lose your balance because you have so much weight right behind the vertebral column. So the vertebral column then courses a little anterior and repositions your head more right over the center of your body. So it's easier to maintain balance. Right, so this is what we call an anterior curvature. Helps you maintain balance. The posterior curvature is there to allow various organs in these cavities, like thoracic cavity, to be there. Same thing for lumbar. It helps adjust weight, and the sacral curvature is there to accommodate pelvic organs, like reproductive organs. All right, so vertebral column doesn't necessarily have to be straight up and down. All right, thoracic. Here's a typical vertebrae, pieces of a typical vertebrae. The next quiz in a couple of days in lab, I'm going to have you draw this out. I'll draw it on the board so you can see how to do it. Here is the strongest part of a vertebrae. We call this the body. And remember, bones are there to resist compression. And this body of a vertebrae just prevents your rest of your body from collapsing down into more inferior regions. So this is the part of a vertebrae that supports a lot of weight. And as you get more and more inferior into your body, these, into your person, I don't mean vertebral body, these vertebrae have to get bigger and stronger because they're holding up more weight. Right? Your cervical vertebrae only holding up your head. The body of vertebrae don't have to be very big and strong right there. Right? So that's its major job. Then it's got a couple processes. Two that are sticking out to the side. Call these the transverse processes. There's one sticking straight posterior. That's called the spinous process. And what's the function of the transverse processes and the spinous process? It's for muscle attachment. Remember, a process is for muscle attachment. And look how rough it is. I can see rough areas right here and here. Muscle attachment. And these vertebrae can be damaged, right? And we have to develop a really nice way of speaking about the different parts of these vertebrae to know where fractures are, right? Because then that might determine what has to be done to help that person. So here is the body. There's a connection between the transverse process and the body, and we call that a pedicle. So here's a pedicle. There's a connection between a transverse process and a spinous process. That's what we call a lamina. And if we put two pedicles and two lamina together, it forms a nice arch that we call the vertebral arch. And then if we add the body to that, that forms a complete hole through the vertebrae that we call the vertebral foramen. And take a guess. Remember, the function of a foramen is passageway. What's passing through this vertebral foramen? It is probably a number of things, but the most important thing, the biggest thing, is the spinal cord. Spinal cord and brain, two parts of the central nervous system. All right, so you can see that this vertebrae is nice armor plating, helps protect not the brain, but the spinal cord. Okay, maybe I'll come back to that in just a little second. I'll draw some more of that on the board. Okay, the way that we name vertebrae, right, is by the division and then by from superior to inferior by number. All right, so if I point to this lumbar division right here, here is, if we count the lumbar, this is the third one down. So this would be called the third lumbar vertebrae. But usually we don't say it like that. We just say L3 because there's no confusion. There's only one L. And how would we talk about this one where I have the cursor right now? What division is it in? What level is it in? Thoracic level or division. At what number is it? That's number 6, so then if we say T6, we know exactly what vertebrae it is. Can't be down here, can't be up over here. Can't be up over here because what do we call all of these up here? These are all cervical, right? And there's 7 of them. Here's C1, here's C2, all the way down to C7, right? All right, now look at these way down over here. These are the coccygeal. We could call these C1, C2, C3, but you might get confused with the cervical vertebrae. So the way that we abbreviate this, at least in writing, right, is we abbreviate these capital C, little o, for coccygeal. So if you ever read a medical report from a radiologist or something, then these coccygeal are going to be CO, not just cervical. Cervical is C. So that is how we name all of these vertebrae. There are two that are so special that they not only have numbers, but they also have names associated with them. And they are C1 and C2. They have names. The first one is holding up the skull. And somebody that looked at that vertebrae was reminded of that mythological Greek god that was holding up the world. Ever see a picture or a statue of a big, strong person holding up the whole world? The planet Earth holding up. Who is the god that holds up the planet Earth in mythology? Atlas, yeah. So number one is also called the Atlas because it's holding up the skull. So let's take a look at the Atlas. So here's C1 or Atlas, same thing. I can see the transverse processes. I can see a nice big vertebral foramen right here. But do you see a vertebral body? That was one of the characteristics of a vertebrae, is to have a vertebral body. And you know what? I just see a nice ring right here. I don't see a vertebral body for C1. And that's an important observation. That vertebral body has gone someplace. We're going to find out where it has gone. Here is a superior articulating surface. Right, superior articulating facets because it's a little dimple, it's a little depression. And this is going to articulate with the occipital bone. Who can tell me the part of the occipital bone that's going to fit in very nicely to this superior articulating facet on C1? We talked about it earlier in this class. It is the occipital condyle. And the occipital condyle, is that going to be a rough surface or a smooth surface? It's going to be raised, right? But rough or smooth, you're going to say smooth because it helps make up a joint. It helps make up an articulation, right? So here is part, the other part of that articulation on C1. Okay, so both of these are of different views of the atlas. C2, all right, let's go down a little bit. Here is C2. And now I can see the vertebral body of C2 very nicely. I don't see it here on C1, but I can see it on C2. Here's the articulating surface for articulating with C1. Here's a little bit of a spinous process, a little bit of transverse processes. Nice vertebral foramen. Okay. And then here's the body. But I want to take another view. Let's look at another view, maybe an anterior view of C2. Hopefully I have it. I have it. I sort of have it here. Okay. Here is C1, right? It forms a nice ring. And then here is C2. And the body is up over here. Here's the body of C2 right up over here. And then attached to the body of C2 is what was the body of C1 at a particular time in development. All right, so it attached to the body of C2. It has dissociated itself from C1. So here is a point that's sticking up right inside, okay, C1, but it's really attached to C2. And as a result, right, C1 can rotate around this particular point. And that's why the C2 sometimes is called the axis, right? Because C1 can rotate around it. So if you look, you can rotate your head to the right or to the left. That's allowed between C1 and C2. You can rotate your head because of this particular joint. This body of C1 that has attached itself to the body of C2, no longer attached to C1, we call that the dens. Or sometimes we call it the odontoid process. Dens or odontoid process. All right, so rotation is allowed between C1 and C2. What kind of motion is that? If I ask you a question, you could shake your head like this. That's my least favorite answer, which is no. The no motion is allowed between C1 and C2, but between C1 and the occipital bone, right, the no motion is disallowed. Only the, what do we call this motion? This is my favorite answer. Yes. Okay. So the yes motion is allowed between occipital bone and C1 because of the shape of these condyles and the occipital condyle, but only rotation between C1 and C2. And for instance, if for some reason you get into an accident, right, and remember, between C1 and C2 is only rotation, only rotation. If you get into an accident and all of a sudden, right, you go through the yes motion, which we call flexion and extension between C1 and C2, that joint hasn't been designed to do that, then the dens has a tendency to break right off and it moves into the spinal cord, and that is usually immediately fatal when that happens. Okay? So that's really good to know about these different structures on the vertebrae. If you get into a car accident and remember, between the occipital bone and C1, that allows for rotation, but if you get into an accident and, okay, you flex and extend, okay, that could break C1 because C1 is kind of a fragile bone right here, and that can be a nice stable fracture, fortunately, right? And if that person is taken care of properly, they won't have any spinal cord injuries. So that's a possibility, but then you have to wear that special like birdcage over your head attached to your shoulders. They call that a halo to stabilize your cervical spine until it heals properly. So C1 can undergo a stable fracture. C2 usually is fatal. So we'll look at those. Thoracic vertebrae, the bodies are a little bit bigger. Spinous processes are a little bit longer. And on the transverse processes, I can see a little dimple right here because there's another bone that's going to articulate on the transverse processes. All right, so what other bone articulates with a thoracic vertebrae? I talked about it a little bit earlier. What makes this a thoracic vertebrae? Something has to attach to it. And that is a rib. That's right, so a rib will attach here on a transverse process. And so we just call these the transverse costal facets, right? And it's for articulation with a rib. Here's that intervertebral space, and it's just not an empty space. These bones don't rub up against each other. There's cartilage between them. That's what we would call an intervertebral disc. Maybe I'll have some time to talk about those intervertebral discs. Lumbar vertebrae. The spinous processes are not very long and pointed. They come straight back. They're kind of squared off. And does a lumbar vertebrae have a rib attached to it? Does it ever have a rib attached to it? Now here's one case where you can say never. A lumbar vertebrae never has a rib attached to it, okay? Because that would make it a thoracic vertebrae. All right, so the sign-in sheet is going around. I think I'm going to stop lecture now so you can get upstairs and study a little bit. The only thing we got to talk about, and we'll do this in lab, is finish up talking about the sacrum and these ribs. We have different kinds of ribs. But where does a rib, what part of the vertebral column does a rib attach to? A thoracic vertebrae. All right, that's the definition of what a thoracic vertebrae is. Okay. All right. So I'll see you guys upstairs probably really soon. I'll open up that study room. And this is a good place for us to stop.